Today on Against the Grain, Jane McAlevey was an exceptional organizer and thinker, and her death on July 7th leaves a gaping hole for the left. She dedicated her life to building working class power in the trenches of the environmental and labor movements and as a radical scholar. McAlevey believed that the left and labor movement abandoned deep organizing in the 1970s in favor of shallow mobilization and even shallower advocacy, but she insisted that the tide could be turned. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. For the last four decades, unions and the left more broadly have struggled, often for survival. Yet there have been some spectacular moments in which people have come together in the millions, such as in 2003 against the Iraq War, or more recently against police violence. But the conundrum has been that these mass mobilizations have been just that, powerful but short-lived. In 2017, I spoke with legendary organizer Jane McAlevey about this paradox. I began by asking her about the difference, as she saw it, between deep organizing and shallow mobilizing.
For me, organizing implies several core things, several core concepts. And the first I like to say is, when you're organizing, when you wake up in the morning every morning, your goal is to figure out how to spend the day really productively engaging people who basically don't want to talk to you or who are not in your Twitter feed or your Facebook feed. Like, my goal every single day of my life when I'm running campaigns, as in last year in Philadelphia, is who are the key people who are not engaging with us? Because if we're going to build supermajorities, what I call building demonstrable supermajorities, that's what we have to do to win a union campaign in a structure, a hospital in the case of most of my work for the last decade. We know that we can win if we can build demonstrable supermajorities that the employer can actually see, right, that the boss can see. So what does that really mean? Why is that organizing? What's that have to do with the original question? So in order to build demonstrable supermajorities where you can see people acting collectively together to do something high risk, usually in the case of a union or going up against Trump, frankly, will also be high risk for lots of folks, there it is. It means that there's a certain bunch of activists. Someone calls the office and says, we want to form a union. And there's a certain bunch of worker activists, and they're ready to go. Like, they're the ones who called for the union. Meanwhile, they aren't enough to actually win in a tough campaign. You actually have to have demonstrable supermajorities to win tough fights.
And so that means the vast majority of the workers who work in a place.
Exactly. And I'm going to make a metaphor to the whole country, though, right? But so in a workplace, in a given workplace, let's just say 1,000. There's 1,000 workers. In order to win a union election, those of us who still win, which is not enough, start with the assumption that we have to get 85% of them affirmatively, positively committed to the campaign before even filing for union election. That's a demonstrable supermajority. That means 85% or more have signed union membership cards, 85% or more have signed, I'm going to vote yes for the union, because our assumption is the minute the campaign surfaces, we're going to get eroded. We're going to lose about 25% is going to get shaved by a right-wing Breitbart-like attack, which happens in every union drive in this country. So back to organizing. So we'll have this core of people who want to talk to us every day. That's the activists inside the workplace. But there'll be a small portion of the people at the beginning of the campaign. So the question is, if you want to actually win, you have to plot a strategy with careful intention to reach supermajorities. And that means finding and engaging strategically with the vast majority of people who are not just coming to the meetings. They didn't call the union office to form the union, but they're in our voter universe. So we actually have to get up and find them. So I can make a metaphor to the whole country about this. But for me, that is the example. Like, the way I think about retaking the United States from the crisis level of evilness that we're facing right now is that we have to get much more clear that, just like in a workplace, if we rely just on those activists who were already predisposed to the union and who were already coming to the union meetings from the first union meeting, we're not winning that way. What we have to actually do is make a conscious plan to get up in the morning and reach out to most of the working class in this country, again, who are not sort of sitting in our Twitter feeds, and they're not and they're probably honestly not listening to KPFA, and they're not listening to Pacifica, and they're not with us already. So, and that's okay, because from my view of 25 years in the field organizing, it really is true that the vast majority of people I've met in the working class in my lifetime, with one decent conversation where you help them themselves connect the dots in the conversation about who the oppressor is and what's wrong, pretty quickly come to understand that capitalism is a really big problem. Maybe not using that word, but like they get that the boss is a problem and that their boss is connected to a bunch of bosses and those bosses are connected too. And so when we stopped doing that, we surrendered most of the country to the kind of crap that we're seeing right now, which is devastating. Right. So organizing is how do we engage the vast majority of people who are not engaging us and do it systematically and do it smartly and do it with a plan. And mobilizing is like mobilizing is great. I mean, I've gone to a million demos. I've been arrested many times. I've been on picket lines. I love a good demonstration. But it's not a measure for us. Even if, like, to your point, even if a demo is big, what I repeatedly say is who's there and how did they get there? And how long can we sustain it for? Which are, again, the same things that I had to learn and relearn all the time when I'm in the field doing work and not writing about it, which is, you know, if we're going to get ready for a strike, which I call the highest sort of threshold of like super high risk action in this country, we have to know we have demonstrable majorities, we have to hold them in high risk moments, and we have to be able to sustain them.
So what you're saying is that even though right now we're seeing a lot of people coming out onto the streets, there's still really a small portion of the population as a whole, and that to be able to make any kind of profound change or even profound resistance, and I guess there's a whole conversation to be had about just saying no to what's happening and actually proposing something progressive and positive as well, but that is just insufficient.
Yeah, it's completely insufficient. And one thing I said, I just came back from being in overseas. And one of the I was giving a keynote speech to the biggest union in England's women's conference. And I opened it by showing a bunch of pictures of the San Francisco March where I was and pictures of me climbing up on buildings and then just big pictures from all over, including one from London. And I asked the participants in the room, which is a pretty big room. I said, was this mobilizing or organizing? Just as a fun opening question. And then, people sort of didn't even know because it was like I was just introducing the two words, right? So people were like, uh-huh. So it led to a really good discussion. And then I said, and did it matter to the intended target? Like, did the women's marches matter to the intended target? So this goes to numbers. And I was trying to be provocative in the front of the room to say, I had a ball. You know what I mean? I have my pussy hat crocheted thing I've been wearing every day. Like, when it gets warm out, it bums me out because it's too warm to keep it on. Okay, so I love having my hat on. Meanwhile, if I'm Steve Bannon, if I'm him, and I start analyzing where those marches were, I don't care. In fact, not only do I not care, oh, great, there's San Francisco. Let me just list the cities. Oh, Toronto. Okay, well, I don't go for it. London, who gives a about that? Okay, Boston. Okay, he's not going to get that vote anyway. New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Seattle. Like, so if they're looking around the country, they don't care because not literally, but I think kind of don't care, to be perfectly blunt about it. A strategist on the right wing looking at the result of the women's march says, we're never winning in those two, three, four, five states anyway. Now, had they're in Alabama or Texas or any number of places where they control things, had we seen hundreds of thousands like we did in some of the big cities in places like that they worry about, that would be a game changer. So my point is both the numbers we have are insufficient and where we have them are grossly insufficient. And so that's what I mean about sort of waking up in the morning and deciding that, like, even though we've got this great turnout of activists, several more things about this. One is I can't believe how many people I recognize every time I go to an action. Like, that's just a problem. I want to go to actions where I don't recognize anybody. And that's too infrequently not the case. And then, yeah, so it's who's turning out, where are they turning out, and how repeatedly are they turning out? And are we actually growing the base of people we have? Right. To me, organizing is about base expansion. Mobilizing is about just pulling from your base and having demonstrations, which could be voting. Right. That's one form of mobilization is voting. Another form is a strike. Another form is blocking a bridge or whatever it is. But we fetishize like the 5-person direct action arrest these days. And it's part of why we have Trump, in my opinion.
We're going to talk a lot about the nitty-gritty of all of these things, but let me just have you go back in time a little bit and talk about why you think something shifted, because you argue in your book, No Shortcuts, that something did change in the 1970s in terms of how people went about organizing. Something, of course, changed very profoundly within the way capitalism was restructuring itself at the time, and perhaps they're connected. But you are saying that also something about how unions and the left went about organizing or not shifted. Tell us what happened then. What did it look like?
Yeah. And I definitely think you're right. And I'd love to, I could sit and interview you one day more deeply about the sort of capitalist crisis. But I think what I'm looking at in terms of what shifted were decisions inside of the sort of, let's say, loosely speaking, progressive movement in the U.S. So I think that they came first in the trade union sector, honestly, and they came through a combination of, you know, right-wing attacks, McCarthyism. I mean, there's a whole series of things that led to just straight red baiting, that led to the outing of, frankly, the best organizers that were in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s in the U.S., right? They were thrown out of the trade union sector. And a combination of internal right-wing reactions like John Lewis and company, who people we think of as a hero, right, the former head of the Congress of Industrial Organizations. And in some respects, he was, but he was also complicit in the removal of a lot of the best organizers from the trade union movement. Now, what's interesting is if you trace them, a bunch of them slip into the civil rights movement and in some ways become the best organizers in the Bannard Rustin, et cetera. Like, the best organizers go into the civil rights movement and they're playing quiet roles in the South. And they're using the same strategies that built an amazing trade union movement. So they get beaten out of one movement by a combination of right-wing attack from the top and complicity from, you know, self-serving, quote-unquote, leaders in the trade union sector by the 1950s. They also get beat out or shot at or killed or jailed out of the civil rights movement, by the way, along with half the black leaders in this country in the 1960s. So by the time you hit the early 1970s, I think several things happen all at once. One is we've just lost either murder, death, jail, or just been destroyed some of the very best skilled teachers and trainers and coaches we had for, like, how do you build mass movement and sustain it? Because I want to argue there are principles and there are methods, and they matter. So the people who were skilled in that, and it's a lineage I inherited because there's still people doing the training work, right? But I don't invent any of it. I inherited every skill I got was, like, trained into me and apprenticed into me by really smart people before me. So the skill set gets sort of beat out of the movement. That's one thing that happens. The second thing that happens is the largest number of sort of working class people ever go to college off the GI Bill, and then their parents go to college. And there's a huge new generation that comes out of the 60s and early 70s, and they pour out of the colleges, out of the anti-Vietnam War movement from college campuses. And it's right at the moment where the women's movement and sort of identity politics is coming to fruition in America. These all stitched together, right? So that's coming to fruition. So there's a moment where you've got a ton of, like, sort of straight white men with a lot of energy coming out of college and the student anti-war movement. And it's a little inappropriate for them to, like, take leadership roles in all these anti-poverty and redistributionist movements in the 70s. And so they take the banner of Alinskyism, of Saul Alinsky's work. And one of the things that Frank Bardacki, many of us have critiqued. So this one aspect of his work, I think a bunch of us critiqued, which is what we call the fake leader, grassroots leader, organizer dynamic. So I think the Alinsky model, which says the organizer doesn't make any decisions, grassroots leaders make them all, becomes a sort of one way that a bunch of straight white men who couldn't otherwise hold leadership take all these organizer roles in the redistributionist movements in the 1970s and pretend that they're not making decisions, which I just say is just a flat joke. Look, I'm an organizer, and when I'm working with thousands of workers, which I just did again in 2016, I don't walk into that room and pretend that I'm not making decisions. Now, the difference is I'm going to make them in the most transparent way possible. I'm actually going to engage people by the thousands in the decision making, but I'm going to be super transparent. Like, I'm walking in, you called us, that means I'm making a bunch of decisions. To even return your phone call means we made a decision, right, as the organizer. So which places we're going to. So I think the shift is, that's one shift. And then I discuss what I think Alinskyism means to the last 40 years, which is, it isn't just that people aren't clear about their role and who's making decisions under Alinskyist sort of models. It's also that they brought with them this very strong anti-ideology into our movement. So at the same time that McCarthyism and the right beat out people who did have more ideological and class-based politics, got beat out of the movement, we had a generation of the Alinskyites that also were particularly anti-ideological. So the whole discussion about, like, who's to blame for what's going on in this country is just taken out of the progressive movement. And it's pretty wild. And I think we spent sort of 40 years, little identity politics stuff, little protests here and there, little shift to, like, individual rights as the concept of what we fight for right now. And the entire discussion of class and capitalism and class politics was systematically and I think strategically moved out of the U.S. movement. And we now find ourselves in a place where people are like, the word class politics doesn't even come up in this country anymore, except with Donald Trump, which is amazing to me.
You're listening to a conversation that I had in 2017 with the influential left scholar and union organizer Jane McAlevey. She died on July 7th. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio.
So at the moment when all of this is happening, these transformations about how people understand organizing, at the same time, on the right, it seems like something else is taking place in terms of organizing. What is happening there, and how does it contrast to what you've been describing on the left?
Yeah. So at the same time, and part of the argument in the book, right, is that at the same time that the sort of the forces under the progressive movement banner writ large begin to do mobilizing, like begin to have a different theory of change, which is a failing theory of change, and begin to just mobilize a bunch of professional staff, lawyers, communications, the early sort of communications ideas. We can just implement the laws we won from the 30s to the early 70s. The right wing realizes, it's the base, stupid. And they literally decide, we're going to start to build this grassroots base that we have watched so effectively be done by people in the trade union movement and the civil rights movement. I'd say less so the movements after that. And I think they literally said, it's the base, stupid, right? So you have the beginning of the Christian Coalition, the Moral Majority, Phyllis Schlafly in particular. Like, I think when they really perfected it was going after the Equal Rights Amendment. And they built this tremendous base, sort of mothers against the ERA, housewives against the ERA, housewives for motherhood. Like, they began to realize that what they had to do was actually take, not exactly, but some of the playbook that that those of us who were winning, you know, in the 30s to the 60s period had taken. So they take a page out of the idea that growing a base all over the country matters. And that's part of what I say and something I wrote just after the election, part of what I say that people missed going into the Trump election was like they kept saying, well, he's got no one on payroll. And I kept saying to people, they're not on his payroll. They're on the payroll of the National Rifle Association, the Christian Coalition. They're all over the country. They have now built this incredibly thriving right-wing base in the evangelical church and in the NRA, and you're just missing it because they're not on his payroll. Like, he's like, I mean, by March, I knew that he was winning, and that was the first time I went on the record saying it. It was just so obvious that they were winning, and I felt like the mainstream media and a lot of consultants and stuff just miss, like, what that he had this huge apparatus out in the field that Koch and all these other entities have been perfecting, you know, for like every decade they come up with a new idea to perfect it. We get the American Freedom, whatever, all the new formations. But they have formations and they have them in the field and they're training armies of ordinary people.
We've mainly been speaking about organizing versus mobilizing. But the other thing that you write that has characterized of the last 40 years has been also the embrace on part of the left, unions, and so on, of advocacy. Explain what advocacy is and why it has not been effective as a way of mobilizing or flexing power.
Yeah, so let me just say what advocacy is, and then I want to tie it to the core, again, one of the core arguments I'm trying to drive in the book. So advocacy, I think, is an offshoot a little bit of the Alinsky model, right? It's you have the sort of grass top stuff. Like, you have really super smart paid professional staff who have taken the place of genuine sort of grassroots leaders, as opposed to the thing that they call grassroots leaders, right, which is they prop up a handful of people behind them at a press conference and whatever. So advocacy is the more direct. It's like the Ralph Nader groups. It could be Greenpeace. It could be any of the institutions that we've grown up where, like, you pay money to some people and then they go do advocacy campaigns on your behalf. And they take good positions, and that's great. I'm glad they're taking all those good positions. But they're not fundamentally teaching the base itself, ordinary people, actually how to challenge anyone in their lives, let alone challenge big, you know, big bosses in capitalism. So that's an advocacy model. And part of what I argue is that that's what's come into the trade union movement. And that's where it sort of meets what mobilizing is. But here's the problem with all of this that I want to just zero in on for a second. The problem with all of it is that power is relative. So how much power we need to win a certain fight, I try and draw in some diagrams in the new book, like these concept of power required and power available. So the advocacy model, I say, can get us some stuff. Like, you know, I'm not picking on Nader. Look, Nader's done some great work. But like the groups that are in that empire, there are certain things that we can win. We can stop with an advocacy approach, with a bunch of smart lawyers and a lawsuit and, you know, well-funded PR machine. But what we certainly can't do with that approach is anything seriously meaningful that requires a lot of power. Because the only advantage that ordinary people have ever had over the big bosses, the biggest bosses, the political system, economic system, is our numbers. And so when you divorce a theory of change from how do we bring mass numbers of people to pull up to the table in a way that I say is like with real agency, like where they're not just being like a mob somewhere, but like where tens of thousands of people pull up to the table and want to have a fight and understand the terms of the fight, that's our strategic advantage. That's why the 1% versus the 99% is that little nice slogan that we have. Right? Great. That is the right slogan. The question is, what are we doing? It's like we say the slogan, and then we have a model that brings in about 3% of the people. And we have to actually get, you know, I think 99% is a little bit, I always say, to me, it's about 85%. It's like 85 versus the, you know, the 15 or something. But
slightly less now.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, like, again, part of what makes this really sharp and clear, if you've been a trade union organizer and or if you've helped lead strikes in the trade union sector, it always takes me back to demonstrable majority stuff. Because when I'm working with workers in a campaign, I say to them a couple of things. One is, look, what we win is completely up to you, not me. So I'm like a skilled technician here. Like I can be a chief negotiator in your contract in Philadelphia this year. But I have no ability to help you. I mean, all I can do is like say to you, here's what the boss is going to do next. Here's a history lesson. I've done this a lot. Boss is going to do this. So before the boss does that, let's do this. Okay. But so I say to them, how much you win in this contract is up to whether or not you can get strike ready and actually strike. So if you can't get strike ready, if you can't get a supermajority of the workers ready to walk off the job in collective action, then here's what we can win. We can probably win a dollar an hour raise or two. We can probably get a weak grievance and arbitration procedure in the contract. But you're not going to win staffing ratios. You're not going to change the culture of what's happening in the production setting, meaning in this case in the hospital, the relationship between the boss and the line workers. But you can get a couple of things. So the metaphor for the country is like we get confused because we can either have a big demo or we like win something that isn't actually that significant. And we think that we're winning. And part of the point is power is relative. And part of what I think our movement doesn't do very well is power analysis or power structure analysis. Mm. We don't pre-think. If we want to win single-payer health care, how much power is actually required to do that? Like, it's one thing to have a nice idea. Part of what makes me crazy about policy groups in the U.S., it's like why I left D.C. years ago, is people sit in the movement, progressive movement, and they write these amazing model policies. Like, you know, we're getting up with this new, and now it's happening, it's making me crazy with all the, what's it called, guaranteed annual income. Like all these things that are meant to be portable benefits that are meant to be replacing a union contract in this country, or class power, should I say, which is a union contract. If you have good class power, then you have a good union contract. They have all these like policy ideas. And I'm like, how the hell are you passing it? How are you passing it? And I don't care if you can write a perfect piece of policy language. We don't have any power to pass it right now. And if you do pass it, you're going to pass it in name only. And there's a bunch of stuff, which if we have time, we should come back to, like some examples of things that we've been passing that the movement goes out and has these big celebrations of, and they're nothing. There's no enforcement mechanisms in them. There's no money in them. There's nothing to do on them. And then we have a celebration about a paper victory. And part of what I'm trying to say is the only way that we can win substantial things again in this country, a la challenging capital in some real way, challenging Wall Street in some real way, it's not by being in Zuccotti Park, fun as it was. I was there every day because I was in grad school then. It's actually rebuilding demonstrable majorities in the working class so that people can fight for themselves and pull up to the table as equals against their bosses and really challenge them. And that there is so much more power. And I just – one closing thought on this question. It's like when I was in – Philadelphia, working this last year with thousands of workers. And the backdrop to this was the whole U.S. election going on and people saying, you know, that the working class, you know, that there was like no, that people were voting against their self-interest, you know, all this sort of stuff. And it's like, it was so good for my soul to be in a traditional old series of union campaigns all during 2016 where ordinary people who could have been independent, not voters or Republicans on the first day I met them, were pulling up and taking strike votes by 4 months later against their bosses and going through radical political education and coming to understand what it means to stand together and build unity and collective action. And that's a different kind of power, and that's the power that we need right now.
I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. We're airing a conversation recorded in 2017 with labor legend Jane McAlevey, who died this week.
So you spoke a moment ago about the need to rebuild power in the working class, and you've been talking about the central role in understanding power, how power is exercised, where it resides for them as well as us, and I will ask you about that in a moment. Obviously, there has been the decline of the union movement since the 70s, and that is clearly part of this picture. You think it's actually central.
Yeah.
But in terms of thinking about building a renewed left, so to speak, what would that look like? Are you saying that unions themselves, rebuilding the labor movement would be enough? When we talk about organizing, what are we talking about organizing people into? Should we be talking about membership-based organizations, which kind of went into decline in the 70s? How do you see it?
Yeah. So I think the tricky thing is we're up against the endless debate about sort of the iron law of oligarchy, right? Which I say with a smile just because you would think that I had heard that term when I was organizing for 20 years before grad school, but I actually hadn't. So now I realize it's like the central, one of the central debates that happens inside of more academic circles. So my answer is...
And can you explain what that is?
Yeah, the iron law of oligarchy. Yes, essentially... What was Robin Michel's, who's a 100-year-plus-old theory now, that essentially says all – it was focused on political parties but and unions, and it was written by an Italian theorist in right late 1800s, early 1900s, and it said essentially all large mass membership organizations like political parties and unions will turn oligarchic, will lose their sort of – if they had it, will lose their small-d democracy, it will lose transparency, and it will sort of serve the needs only of a handful, a small handful of powerful players who are leading the institution. And it will lead – it will inevitably lead away from its sort of core purpose that it began with. So I think, and that frames a lot of the imagination of the critique that I hear about trade unions in this country, and it makes me blisteringly crazy for several reasons. One, it isn't true. So there are several really good books that have been written, I'm sure more than that, just that I know of, about the history of trade unions in this country that really clearly explain. One of them is Left Out. It's a terrific book, Reds in the American Industrial Unions. And it outlines how of the best unions in the 1930s and 40s, before McCarthyism, before the heyday of the right-wing attack on our very good unions, before the sort of invasion of Reds and the paranoia of the Cold War, that the best unions in this country were always democratic. Best meaning workers won the most. Their life was transformed the most. the unions were democratic, like members had a say in them, that they were always the left-led unions. Okay, so they were literally left-led. And what I loved about that book was it actually outlined, they studied the constitutions of all of the unions at the time and of what's called the 18 red-led, meaning it was led by communist socialists, the 18 red-led unions in the 1930s and 40s. They had by far the most democratic internal institutions. So that's one piece of evidence I just loved seeing because it was something I sort of knew in my bones from contemporary times, but I had never just sat down to read, which was a good thing for me to do in grad school. So, but in my own life experience, it's also not true. So the union that trained me is 1199 New England, totally radical union and still a totally radical union and has an incredible internal democracy to it. And it's the way I was taught to sort of engage in the way that I've always run either a contract fight or a union as well, which is open, democratic, transparent. You know, there's all these basic things that we say, like every single worker is allowed in the room of negotiations, like ask many unions in this country, let any worker into negotiations. I'm sorry to say it's almost none. But those that still are, we're all the ones that are still winning, like life-altering contracts. So that's to say, it's almost like I had to inoculate by saying all that first to say, yeah, we have to actually build strong unions again. Like, we actually have to do that. And A, there are a bunch of them out there. And I think what I'm going to write about this year, depending if Trump just gets in the way of everything I'm trying to do, because we have to build power instead of just writing about it. But if I write about power again soon, I'm going to take even more recent examples. I'm chronicling everyone who's been doing strikes in the last couple of years. And the union that I was just working for in Pennsylvania, PASNAP, all last year, you know, I was on the phone with them yesterday. I was calling to chat about some talk I'm going to give, some work I'm going to do with their annual meeting in a couple of weeks in Philadelphia. And they couldn't talk because they were going off to get ready for a two-day strike right at Delaware County Memorial Hospital. Like, oh, can't talk now. We're getting ready for the two-day strike. And I was like, right. And there's this whole myth out there that there aren't strikes in America. Mm-hmm. And it isn't. Of course, there's way less strikes. Of course, way less strikes. But two things are happening. One is the number that most of researchers look at is a Bureau of Labor Statistics number. And it's for strikes in workplaces of 1,000 or over because that's what the BLS numbers track. And what a lot of people are missing is that the number you have to look at is at the FMCS, Federal Mediation and Conciliation Services data, where strikes or work stoppages for under 1,000 workers happen because our workplaces have shrunk. So there's like so many, not enough, but there's so many more strikes happening than people think there are. And I want to write about them. And so because what anyone who's not anyone, I mean, you could have a right-wing union run a strike if you're a cop union for sake of argument. But most service workers unions who are striking, so structurally weaker workers in today's economy, meaning they're easily replaceable, those unions where they're still running mass strikes almost by definition means that they're internally democratic, that there's high participation. Like when I do trainings, I call it building high participation unions because if we're building high participation, it again, almost by definition means that we're building a small democratic trade union. And so I think, yeah, we have to build class power, and I don't know a better way to do it than by building strong unions. And there's a lot of them out there. And what we think of right now is like, you know, the image everyone's been sending around of Rich Trumka, which I haven't even looked at, but I've gotten a ton of emails about it, like how embarrassing it was saying something nice about Trump again, or you know, a handful of building trade unions pulling up to the table, you know, with like the men of power and Steve Bannon and Conway and Trump at that table. That's not the labor movement. That's a handful of unions inside of it. And we're so naive. Our whole progressive movement is so naive about unions and trade unions for a lot of reasons, which we might come back to and I touch on in the book, right? But thanks to Alinsky and some other players who like, and even this whole right, C. Wright Mills era, like the whole era that said unions are bad, which started in the 60s. And they're sellouts. And I just think every union I've ever worked for in my adult lifetime, which is contemporary times, have not been sellouts, have been largely great. I mean, of course, there's problems all over the place. But like there's amazing local unions all over this country and there's amazing independent unions. And I think when people say, let's come up, let's think of another, let's forget the unions and come up with another thing. The issue is anytime you are actually contending with power, which unions can do and have done, and so the civil rights movement, right? And so murders, death, destruction, right? Anytime our movement gets close to contending for real power, infiltration, all sorts of things start. And the top officers can start getting diluted by their own power, right? So the whole question is, we don't need a new formation. We need to get much more clear on what are the governance mechanisms that keep our unions democratic and strong. And I don't think as long as we live under capitalism, there is any choice but to build worksite-based, workplace-based worker power that can contend outside of the electoral arena, in the economic arena, against bosses, and eventually get up to having more mass strikes again. We know how to strike still. Some of us are still doing it. It's kind of happening out there. And I don't think, again, if we move to a different political economic system, then we maybe can have a different formation. But as long as we're living under capitalism, or what they call democratic capitalism, we have to have unions. And that means running some existing leaders out of office, just like we need to run a bunch of bad people in the Democratic Party out of office or whatever it is, run them out, take them over, which lots of rank and file folks are doing at the local level in this country right now, and maybe build some new ones. But I don't think there's the idea of, like, I hate the word innovation right now so much, because everywhere I go, it's like, oh, we need to innovate our way out of the capitalist crisis. No, we're not innovating our way out of the crisis. The basic guaranteed income is not an innovation. What they're talking about now is $1,000 a month. For Christ's sake, that's poverty. Like, who cares about a guaranteed annual income if the guaranteed income is poverty?
Sure. And it's an idea in the right, not surprisingly, as well as the left. And how do you see building this kind of class power? And one of the criticisms that have been leveled against unions is that they've organized not for class power, but kind of sectoral power, these particular workers, not the working class as a whole. How do you think about organizing for that broader power, whether it means the unwaged or people in communities who are not in these particular jobs and therefore in these unions? How do you organize on behalf of the whole working class?
Yeah, so a couple of things. One is, I think it's in recent times when people point to unions and say that, because if you look at the 1930s and the 1940s, where basically all the organizers had the same politics about organizing that I have, right? Because that's where I inherited mine from. So if you look at it, they didn't conceive of the union fight or the union contract as this narrow thing. And they were being led by broader left parties who, in fact, were doing the unemployed workers movement, but they were also strategically targeting key industries. So, I mean, the dilemma is that each of these, I feel like we could talk about for hours. But so on this one, I think two things. One is, in the book, I say we have to have strategic industries right now. As the core driving strategy, that's different than all the work we have to do, right? So there's, like, what's the centerpieces of our strategy and what's the totality of our strategy? In the 1930s, they had core industries, and they had them for a reason. There were strategic industries, auto, steel, coal, et cetera, right? I'm arguing right now in the new book that we have strategic industries today, and it's education largely and healthcare, two giant sections. Why? A, they're still growing. B, the robots can't replace them, not yet, and not for a while. Like, even people who believe in the robot thing, like, it's still a ways off. And I'm arguing when we do our organizing work the correct way, the good way with good methods attached to it, we actually can build power really fast. And part of the argument I make in the book is whether it's Chicago teachers, the union I ran in Nevada, Pennsylvania this year. I mean, the Smithfield campaign, all the case studies used in that book. And now the guy in Seattle writing to me, the teachers union leader in Seattle, who sent me like an internal essay he's never published about how they transformed their union in Seattle to have the big 2015 strike that was in Seattle. It doesn't take long. And that's maybe the best thing I can say is when we organize according to the principles and methods that people smarter than us decades back thought about, we can actually make transformational changes really fast. So I think... Yeah. So one, I think it can happen fast. And two, I think it's not really right to look at a union and say, even one that may just be building sectoral power, and say they're only fighting for the workers in the workplace. Because, again, that's what your principles are. So what I argue is there's principles and methods. So if your principle is, if your purpose-driven principle is to help build class power, every place I've done it, the centerpiece of the strategy is building workplace power inside the workplace. But I have a very strong philosophy, which is called the whole worker approach, which means that every single worker that we're building strong and teaching in a tough workplace fight getting their experience, getting them to have some experiences of winning under their belt, meaning them, meaning like thousands, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, getting people to have experiences of winning, the experience of struggle against a tough fight in the workplace first is what I argue. And then we chart all of their social relationships outside of work. And then we actually engage the same workers about, hey, when you punch the clock and go home, at what's happening out in the broader neighborhood. And the way we ask the question literally in real life is, hey, by the way, if you were mayor tomorrow, like we win a huge contract, workers newly in the union, or they've a renewal contract, and we say, when you punch the clock, when you go home, if you were mayor, what are the first three things that you would change tomorrow? And I've never not had a worker who thinks about the union first as a workplace structure not be able to answer the question about if they were mayor tomorrow, what's one, two, or three things they'd do in their neighborhood. And that question alone gives us an insight into the key issues that are affecting the workers in that broader region. And then we roll through the workers into broader community fights around the issues that have been named by the rank-and-file workers themselves. So affordable housing, immigration, toxic cleanup. I mean, I think the question is a confusion. There's so much confusion going on. So in the whole worker method, it is never about just winning a contract in the workplace. It is about understanding, though, that people need to be enabled in a fight so that they can learn the experience of collective struggle, be successful in it, and then begin to think much broader about their whole community. And how are we going to bring the whole working class along in this community? And that, I argue, is what trade unions should be doing. I think it's what we did in the 30s and 40s, and it's certainly what I've been doing my entire adult life in every single, like, large market, meaning, you know, I think in terms of markets, not cities or metropolitan areas, but like labor markets, because we fight capitalists inside of a labor market. So I argue in every labor market and every campaign I've run, there's the immediate fight we have in the workplace. And then once the workers are skilled into their new, own, stronger, almost independent army, we then unleash the same army on the broader working class fights in that region. So I just think it's, look, if you're a trade union organizer or leader with a really narrow sense of what that means, you're not building a working class movement anywhere. You're just an advocate, probably, doing the work on behalf of workers in the union context anyway. If you're a left or progressive trade unionist, you understand from day one that there's a strategy. There's something that you do on day one, day two, day five, year one, year two in a new labor market area. But if you're a left trade unionist, you are by definition building a working class movement on issues that are not just in the contract.
One of the things that you write about in No Shortcuts is the paramount importance in locating power, not just within the working class, but also within the ruling class, and that other models of trying to affect social change often pay very little attention to who our target is. Can you explain how you zero in on that and what the implications are for disruption, which you argue is essential in actually affecting some kind of change?
So in traditional union research, a good union will stop to think about who's the decision maker, but they'll be looking at it in the context, in a very narrow and limited context, in my view, like stock portfolio, crashing the, you know, stock price for the day, doing a brand damage campaign. And I'm less interested in brand damage because I'm interested in teaching workers by the millions how to fight, right? Not in some sophisticated brand damage strategy that's on high from Washington, D.C. So who's the decision maker in a fight in this community? But not just who's the decision maker, but where are all the secondary and tertiary forms of leverage? Starting with, here's a target. Maybe that target's too powerful for us to attack straight on. What are the things that target themselves want to win in this geographic area for the next 5 to 10 years? If I start to understand the broader agenda that the target has in a given effort, it may be that we find that the way to actually pull a win is because we've come to a deeper understanding about not just who our target is in our immediate fight, but what are all the things, and I want to say this about Trump and Bannon and these people too, that the left is not doing this right now. Like, what are all the things that the target actually really wants to get done in local markets, in social structural contexts? And then how do you map a series of relationships around a given target so that you can begin to, like, cut them off at every single possible angle of things they're trying to get done? So for me, just as a metaphor, nationally, I mean, Trump, for God's sakes, is in real estate. Like, first and foremost, he's a scumbag making money in real estate. So there are zoning boards and planning boards all across this country, and they're all across the world where his stupid golf courses and stuff. Now, we're not going to stop him in Dubai, but, you know, there's a lot of ways to go after him in the capitalist economy around real estate stuff. And we're just, like, playing with disruption protests right now that if Bannon's looking around the country, he doesn't care about them because they're not happening in Alabama or Tennessee or Texas or swing voter states, right? So anyway, that's like, I digress. Sorry. But so the question is, do you have a method? You just need to have a method. Our ability to do really good strategy and strategic thinking is tied to our ability to do really good power structure analysis. And there's not enough of either, and they're related.
Well, perhaps you could expand on just what you're talking about right now in letting us think about how this would all come together at a moment right like the strange moment of the present, which seems very disorienting, but in many ways also seems the culmination of kind of decades-long march toward stripping away the gains of the labor movement, the civil rights movement, the environmental movement. People have a great sense of urgency about the moment, especially as, you know, Trump defunds the EPA, and often urgency can actually make us not think too clearly because we just see the pressing needs of the moment and we want to act immediately. So whatever might be most spectacular perhaps might come to mind. And organizing sounds like a longer term project. It sounds less appealing. How would you say we should come to this moment beyond sort of targeting, say, Trump's real estate holdings and, you know, making him feel uneasy there, but really in terms of building the kind of collective power, class power, that not only could actually stop or put limits on what's going on, but actually might even look towards making new demands and gains. What would that look like in this moment?
So I think it is a combination of things, right? There's sort of the immediate, there is the immediate defense action. And I feel like activists, capital A activists, I characterize by in part by people who do just want to go do things, sort of get something done. I feel like it'd be great if that could be channeled into like the immediate needed defensive fights that we have, like going to surround someone's house, maybe from ICE showing up or a workplace or something. So I would, like, to me, organizing is also like if you're an organizer, it's sort of like playing the role of a coach on a big team. So it's like looking at the troops, recruiting people into certain positions, and then enabling them to go. So there's the target, there's an analysis of power required to win, and then there's where's the available power. Those are the matrix that I'm always looking at in the war room. And I don't think they look that different now than they do at any given moment. But I think in my war room, I'm not focused on 2018. Like, I'm going to let the losers in the Democratic Party or whoever it is, like, go worry about that. Because I don't think there's a ton of promise between now and the 2018 cycle. But I think it is possible to think about 2020. So one thing is elections. So I actually think elections matter. And here's why I want to say I think elections matter. And I get in debates with sort of lefties a lot about this, because on the one hand, I'm saying class power, get in the workplace, build power. But here's why I think elections matter, not just because, like, you can see in California, it feels really different to live in California right now based on who is in the state legislature and some of the city councils compared to, I don't know, any number of states in the country, right? So it feels safer. I mean, when I walk down the street and I see the undocumented person who works in our neighborhood this morning and he's like, we're okay in California, right? Like, it feels different in California because we have elected good people to office. And it's like kind of right. People feel kind of safe here right now. And that's false and true, right? So, but here's why I really obsess about leftists needing to embrace electoral politics, because if you don't get yourself into a contested fight where you win or lose something, you will never know if you're winning. So part of my argument about local politics isn't just that we need a bench, but in the trade union sector, we have elections. Okay, some people have set that model out, but those of us who are still running elections, like National Labor Relations Board elections, which we just won 7 of in Philadelphia in a row, like a whole bunch of us are still winning them. So I think you have to have timelines and you have to have yes or no contest. Part of why the left has to embrace local elections and local races is because You need to put yourself in a yes or no voting context to know if you're really winning or building power. In the trade union sector, we have all these things that are yes or no moments. Do you win the election? Yes or no. Do you win the first contract? Yes or no. Do you build to a strike? Yes or no. Do you? So there's like, I can look at my work any day of the week when I'm running real campaigns, and I can be assessed in a very hard way. Did you win or did you lose? Did you win or lose by a lot or a little? If it's a contract, did you win really substantial life-altering things or, you know, the proverbial raise, which somehow has become the success today of what we're doing as opposed to building power? So I think that the left – so if I'm in the war room, 2020 matters to me and local elections matter, because I think that every time I meet progressives or lefties – who are like, they want to check out of the Democratic Party or check out of the electoral system. I'm like, that's cool. But if you can't prove to me that you can win anything, that you can build demonstrable majorities and do something, how do you know what you're doing is winning anything? Like, we have to win. And for our army to grow, like what I argued in Raising Expectations in the first book is that, like, the first thing we have to do is raise the expectations of ordinary working class folks that we can win again. And as soon as people sense that they can win again, they are off and running. So to me, I'm trying to think about how do I build – if I was building a national war – so your question is sort of like, what would the national war room look like? And one is definitely getting people way more involved in local races. Forget the congressional. Just forget it. Like school board and California water boards, LAFCO. Like there's all these commissions, committees, things that we just leave to the developers and the right, the Donald Trumps and his kids and their ilk and the right. And we should be taking all of them. That would be one part of the war room. And that is about – creating neighborhood-based associations if you're a leftist. Like, stop just going to demonstrations. Like, figure out what in the next local elections coming up. Is it a CSD, a community service district? Is it a water board in your region? Is it the fire board? Start mapping with your neighbors. Now, you can go to the website Who Rules America, which is Bill Domhoff's at UC Santa Cruz. They have an amazing website for just basic local power research, just basic. Just like if you're a leftist and you're frustrated of going to protest, go to a website called Who Rules America. Push their website. Some really basic tools on there. And figure out, like, what are the next set of local elections coming up? And then start to figure out what would it take for you to run, either you or maybe you feel more like an organizer, not the leader type, to go recruit a team of people in your neighborhood or your precinct or your something. And again, it's not because you're entranced with the idea of electoral politics. It's because you got to start figuring out, can you build some power? Are you winning something or do you lose everything you're doing? So if you're in an organized workplace, I think one of your first jobs, because there's huge resources still and the class power fight is really real, you should be running. You should be getting some schooling, reading my book and a bunch of others and figuring out how do you actually do that, right? And actually getting together with a bunch of good coworkers and figuring out, can you take over and run and contest for the local union? If you don't have a unionized workplace, then you should be also reading my books and a bunch of others and figuring out the right union to be in touch with, not the wrong one because there's right and wrong, the right union to be in touch with, and then get some coaching because it's going to be a lot harder than you think it is. That's what people should be doing on the class fight side in the immediate. And then the second thing is if those opportunities are not available, you're in a more rural area or you're in a safer area or something, then go literally do a research on what the local elections are that are coming up, figuring out how they tie to your everyday life, and start recruiting people and decide. And we're going to build – first, we're going to have a house party in this block. And we're going to see if we get the majority of our neighbors to come to a house party. And you're thinking, why do I want to do that? Because then I got to go talk to the guys down the street who leave their things out and piss me off. And I don't like them when I see them on the – that's the whole point of organizing is you got to get over it. Like, building class power is not always fun every day, though. It sure as hell is fun when we win. And we win enough that it – you know, we have to do it or we're going to die.
That was a conversation that I had in 2017 with legendary organizer Jane McAlevey. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening. And please tune in again next time.